This show is brought to you by The Makery, the podcast network for makers.
Are you ready?
Yup.
Guys, we're here. It's another episode of Great Question with Pat Quinn. I'm Jeff Fader. By the way, this is the Full Blast Podcast, and we're here with Pat Quinn. But before we get to it and answer your questions and talk about CMA and all that great stuff, let's take care of a little business. First things first, I want to thank my friends at Broadbeck Ironworks. Broadbeck Ironworks are the makers of the 2x72 grinder. This thing is sick. I love this grinder, and you will too. So go to broadbeckironworks.com, put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, and you get 10% off the grinders. You get 10% off all the packages and the attachments. So definitely check it out, and many thanks to them. I want to thank my friends at EvenHeat, manufacturers of the finest heat treat ovens available. To find your next oven, go to evenheat-kiln.com, get that tap control, solid state drive. If you're trying to harden knives, harden hammers, harden tools that need to be hardened, you get yourself squared away. Get yourself an Even Heat. I want to thank my friends at Maritime Knife Supply. It's maritimeknifesupply.com. Lawrence Lake is amazing for all your knife making needs, belts, abrasives, steels, kilns, forges, press, heat treating ovens, all that stuff. And he's got his website squared away for if you're a Canadian. He's got a website squared away if you're American and everybody else. Definitely support our guy. Lawrence Lake is doing a lot for the New England School of Metalwork and Center for Metal Arts, and I really, really appreciate his support. So definitely support MaritimeKnifeSupply.com. P.S., get the Norton Razor Stars. Those belts are the yellow belts. Those things are rippers. Unbelievable. Next are my friends at Trojan Horse Forge, makers of the Stable Rail Knife Finishing Vise and T4 Sentinel Oil. Get all that stuff at TrojanHorseForge.com, and when you put in the promo code FULLBLAST10, you get 10% off. Next are my friends at Baker Forge. Baker Forge is a new product. Not only do they make great exotic steels with all sorts of copper, my bronze, my sand, my all that stuff, and you can it comes annealed, ready to use. Stock removal, guys, this is the stuff for you. Go to BakerForge.com and put in the promo code FULLBLAST. You get 10% off. They also have Gator Piss. You know what I'm talking about. That's that special etching. They got three of them now. Gator Piss, Gator Piss Heavy, Gator Piss Max. You know all about it, but they have a new product that I think you're going to be excited about. It's called Grime Reaper. The Grime Reaper is degreaser. It's citrus scented. Smells wonderful. That's what they say. 50 state compliant, melts grease and grime, breaks down all the heaviest buffing compounds, leaves no residue to interfere with their etching acids, priced economically to compete with standard brake cleaner products, and it'll be available in single cans and case quantities. You just spray on the braid, spray liberally on the braid, blade, scrub blade with cloth or paper towel, get all that grease and grime off. And etch dried in Gator Piss. I mean, the Grime Reaper, ain't can't get much better than that. Sounds good to me. I already used it, and it smells fantastic. So all of a sudden, you got something nice that smells good. It's got no harsh chemicals, and it's squared away. So get yourself some of that Grime Reaper at Baker Forge. You can also go to Texas Farrier Supply to get your Gator Piss. Go to TexasFarrierSupply.com, and if you put in the promo code KNIFETALK10, you get 10% off everything. Texas Farrier Supply does great stuff. They have blacksmithing supplies, bladesmithing supplies, knife making supplies, farrier stuff, however you identify. You get that, get put in that Knife Talk 10 for 10% off at TexasFarrierSupply.com. I'm going to go see my guys at Total Boat. I'm going to do a demo, a two-day demo with Total Boat. Total Boat makes great adhesive, paints, primers, polishing compounds, and they make this amazing epoxy. I love their epoxy. I use their two-part epoxy exclusively for my handle scales. I use their CA glue exclusively. And I use their Fathom Deep Set to make a hybrid handle material. And I'm going to be doing a demo with them this weekend at Maker Camp. And I'm psyched. So go definitely if you're at Maker Camp, this comes out on Friday. If you're coming to Maker Camp, it's going to be 2 days. Go check out the Maker Camp situation, and I'll be there. If it's good enough for Keith Deese and Derek Vermal, Keith Johnson, and that scoundrel Jimmy Duress, is good enough for you. So go to totalboat.com/fullblast. All the links are in the bio, so definitely where you're listening to this. Actually, not in the bio. Wherever you're listening to this, all the links and all the promo codes, all that stuff is definitely there. Next are my friends at GL Hansen Sons. It's g.l.underscore Hansen Sons. They're making G-Carta. Go to gcarta.bigcartel.com and see that unique composite of natural fibers and fabrics mixed with epoxy under pressure. They just sent me, Greg sent me some trout scales, and they look really great. So the stuff's really easy to use. It's fantastic, and it's going to put some razzle-dazzle in your ding-dong. So definitely get yourself involved with them, and make sure that you check out what he's doing. Go to gcarter.bigcartel.com. I want to thank my friends at Tormach. Tormach, celebrating 50-plus years of being in business with the Black TA sharpening system. I love the Tormach. I'll tell you why I love it. I'll break it down real easy. It moves slowly. It doesn't remove too much material. It has guides and guardrails to make sure that you're successful. It'll help you make very repeatable edges, and you're going to be psyched. I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I have 6 or 7 of them. So I'm going to make a car someday, a real slow-moving car. I'm going to put them upside down on a pallet, and I'm going to roll as slowly as possible down the road. Definitely go check out Tormach. Get your sharpening right. And go to Tormach_sharpening on Instagram for more. And check out my guys over there. Go say hi to Carl, Sebastian. Go say hi to Jack. Those guys are awesome, and I love those guys. And this customer service is awesome. If you're in Australia and you're thinking to yourself, boy, I really like to buy all this stuff, but I want to make sure that I know what I'm doing beforehand, go to NordicEdge.com. That's Nordic_edge on Instagram. If you're in Australia, they do a lot of hands-on education. They do leatherworking, blacksmithing, spoon carving classes, and then you're going to be able to get a little bit more of an idea of what you want to do or execute your creativity in the way that they like it or the way they'll teach you. They have the guidance to help accelerate your creativity and the tools, products, and supplies to help you manifest your ideas. They definitely have great file guides. Their file guides are outstanding. And actually, if you want to get one of their file guides, you go to maritimeknifesupply.com, and they have the Nordic Edge file guides with the bolt-on carbides, which are really outstanding. Baker Forge, NordicEdge.com.au. I said Nordic Edge is a Maritime Knife Supply. That's right. And not last but certainly not least, I want to thank my friends at Phoenix Abrasives, phoenixabrasives.com. Phoenix Abrasives supplies a superior abrasive products for every application: knife making, metal fabrication, glass fabrication, floor sanding, and crankshaft. Belts, grinding, cutting discs, flap discs, surface grinding or surface conditioning belts and abrasives, they got what you need. I use them. I definitely get some belts from them. And if you go to checkout at phoenixabrasives.com, put in promo code FB10 and you're going to get 10% off your entire order. They have all sorts of different products and stuff like that. So definitely, without question, get yourself some of that Phoenix Abrasives. Stop playing. I just got back from the Center for Metal Arts in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. Again, I had a wonderful, inspiring time with my man, Pat Quinn, who's here. He is the director of the Center for Metal Arts, and he's just the most wonderful host. And every time I'm down there, I'm so inspired by the things that they've done and the sculptures, the new sculptures and the classes and the excitement. And it's so great. Pat, how are you?
Yo, I'm good. How you doing?
Dude, every single time I'm down there at the Center for Metal Arts, I come every 6 months or so, I'm never surprised. I'm always amazed at the additions that you provide or the additions to the school in terms of new restorations, new plans, and the new sculpture, the new class sculpture. It's amazing.
Yeah, always adding. I'm like the math man, always making additions.
I'm amazed that, you know, you have such a small crew down there, and the massive additions are always just like, it's exciting.
Right, but you know, as far as crew size, it's really the whole community. So I kind of have a huge crew if you look at it from that perspective. I mean, we get a lot done with a small day-to-day crew, but all these massive additions and work in the octagon and large-scale sculptures, that takes the whole community's effort, which is something I'm really grateful and thankful for, but worth mentioning. So it's like that kind of stuff is really community driven, you know?
You're right. I misspoke because what I love is you just finished the Forging Focus. Was it a 2-week program?
That was Collaborative Sculpture.
Oh, my bad. Yeah. My bad. Collaborative Sculpture was a 2-week program. You had Jake James down, yeah. And you and this amazing group of Smiths and students, you all just knocked out this monster sculpture, this beautiful arch. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, it was, you know, the first time we ever, well, it's only the second time hosting Collaborative Sculpture in the Octagon, and the first time with a visiting instructor. And so the piece was, you know, conceived and designed by Jake James, and is quite ambitious, and it really is a nice addition to the campus, and was a wonderful learning experience for everybody, and it challenged us in a lot of ways in the Octagon that we'd never been challenged before, like both from scale but also technique, like using the hammers in much different ways, which was really exciting, specifically bending those big arches on the 4000. And so the piece was really interesting and exciting because it was a lot different than a lot of the other stuff that we had forged in there up to this point. So yeah, what an experience, man.
Totally different. This is the other thing is as soon as I kind of came in, I walk, you have this really beautiful area. The buildings are on one side of this train track, and then the other side is there's the river and the bridges, and you have these sculptures mounted outside. And when you look at these giant sculptures, every single one of them has its own voice, and they're all different. And the neat thing is I remember one of the first times I met you was years ago when Jake James was at Center for Metal Arts in Florida, and you guys were doing a collaborative sculpture. Mm-hmm. And the work that I've seen that Jake James do, there's faces and there's buildings and there's, you know, you, they're recognizable as, you know, they're not abstract. Mm-hmm. And this particular sculpture, it was so far different from anything I've seen him make that it had Jake James, you know, the fingerprint of Jake James, but it was so different than the things that I'm used to him seeing.
Yeah, definitely. I feel the same way about it. And I think, you know, when artists are challenged to design something, you know, to be made in that shop under those hammers, it might be something to expect that it's maybe a little bit out of the realm of what they usually make, because, you know, that shop is sort of out of the realm of where people usually work. So, you know, when I design sculptures to be made in there, or, you know, invite other artists to make work in there, we try hard to create work under certain parameters that I find to be really successful in that space, based on the size of the hammers and the availability of, you know, general conveniences or not available conveniences. So, you know, it's, you can't just design whatever you want mostly. So yeah, it's kind of, maybe it's a little bit natural that they're slightly different than what an artist usually makes.
What I loved is when we were talking and you were kind of explaining. So to describe the sculpture, and I'm going to use the Jake James sculpture with you in it as the, if you go to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram, that's going to be the thumbnail. It's like, when you look at it, the first thing you think of is it's like this wave that kind of erupts out of the ground on one side and makes this big giant arc, and then it kind of lands on the other side. And then there's a lot of contrasting elements. You have the arc, and then you have this kind of like, I guess you would, it'd be kind of like similar to like sea foam or something like that, where it's like, it's exploding out from where the arc, where the wave comes out of, and then where it lands. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I loved talking to you about, and I felt like it was a lot of fun for me, as always, talking to you in regards to the direction of Center for Metal Arts and how you do, but the way you talked about building, you know, the arch itself, you created this new tooling for the hammers in the Octagon. Mm-hmm. And do you want to talk a little bit about that tooling?
Yeah, well, I knew there was going to be a lot of, bending and forming involved in making this sculpture, and which is, going into it, that was one of the things that was sort of exciting to me about it, because we'd not really done too much in the way of that before in that shop. So I was, talking with Jake and the crew about how to best facilitate those kind of moves under the hammer, and I basically took that like 3-point sort of bending philosophy that you see a lot on like fly presses or hydraulic presses and things like that, and fabricated a very large one to go onto the bottom die of the 4000, and then the top tool was a handheld, round back flatter, 6-inch out of 6-inch round. So it's quite a big radius for that tool, but really worked well on that hammer. So, I was the driver of the 4000 for this workshop, and my team was challenged with the task of knocking down all this big material into tapered sections and then using that 3-point bending system to form these big arches. And it was really, really fun. I felt like it demanded a lot of patience and attention to detail, and it was incredibly slow, and bending very, very thick material hot, and it was really re rewarding. And my team really gelled well over there, and created these arcs to match these templates and all this kind of stuff. But what was really fun about it was that even though the material was really big, like certain sections were like 3 by 6, and we were
Wow.
bending them the hard way. And so, but with the 4000, we'd bring it over, and I would just rest the die on the material, and then give the hammer air and use it like a press, not like a hammer, and it would just bend as the air was being pushed against the ram. And it was really, really awesome and super methodical and peaceful. And it was just to work big material that's so hot with such a big hammer with so much finesse was so rewarding.
Because I would think, we were talking yesterday when you were giving a you were usually you give a tour of the octagon to when there are classes and workshops, which is just like it. Everybody who walks into that area, their eyes just bug out, and it's just like you can just see the imagination of what are they doing in here? What can you do with these? It's always awesome going in there and talking to people and just kind of watching them react. When you're bending that arc, you were well, just to back it up a little bit, what's interesting was you were talking about how the a smith, when they have a piece of steel that's hot in a forge, they automatically grab the tongs and then they're trying to pull it out immediately, and you don't realize that at the weight of the material that's in the forges in the octagon, 200 pounds, 400 pounds. You just can't, it's just impossible to actually get a lot of the steel out by one guy with a pair of tongs out of the forge.
Right.
I'm wondering, when you're bending that arc and the arc is actually is kind of like moving up, how do you hold this giant material where one end is up in the air and then the other end is up in the air? And I know it's a number of 100 pounds. And how do you manipulate that arc where am I wrong? Are the legs are both up, right?
The legs are up. Well, but yeah, you're not wrong. I think maybe it's worth it to talk about some scale here because, the arch was broken into several sections, right? So, no section of the arc or the arch was longer than 7 feet. So it's like when you're forming that thing on the hammer, and you're bending it, and both the tips are going up as you're bending it. Yes, but it's not such a long piece of material where those bends go really high up in the air, and the
Okay.
arc is really gradual. So, in the the forming of it is so low.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
Impact that the team just was able to hold the material with big flat jaw or V-bit tongs, and you just kind of like supporting it as it forms, letting the material kind of rise up as it's being bent, and you're just there to prevent it from like toppling over, which it doesn't really want to do. They're just there to kind of like slide it and advance it on the bending jig as we're gradually creating this arc.
It's so amazing. And it's if I were to look at all the sculptures, there's the beautiful sculpture that you did with the team, and then there's the Pete Matilla sculpture, the giant wall that a lot of people have seen, and then there's the sculpture that you, the first sculpture you guys did with Ballard Forge. And one of the things that this one represents is more movement. You know, mm-hmm. this one is dynamic. You know, where it's coming out of the ground and coming, making this incredible arc. Sculpture is one of the hardest things to kind of create. Steel sculpture, especially, is one of the hardest things to create the concept of movement. You have this material that's so heavy and it's so massive. And when you see the sculpture that's coming out of the octagon, it's just like, it's massive. It's monumental forged sculpture. It's so hard to create that concept of movement with this very strong, permanent material.
Yeah, well, I think that's one of the very successful aspects of this most recent sculpture. Is one of the first comments out of most everybody's mouth is it, you know, the sense of movement is really there. And the, even though those big like forged like 2-inch plate forms are quite heavy and still very thick in certain cross sections, It has a lightness to it and a movement to it that's really captivating to the viewer, you know, because we all know how big and heavy these pieces and this material is. So, you know, from that perspective, obviously very, very successful.
And it's all very overwhelming, if you mind me saying, because it's like, that great part is you're seeing the sculpture and you're seeing this material, and you know that it's forged because you have the, you know, the fingerprints of the process. It's all just, it's just awesome. It's, yeah. I hope that you're happy with how things are going.
I am, dude, but I'm also, you know, constantly refining and reflecting and all that kind of stuff, you know. So every year is a really informative learning experience, and so after every one of these, well, this is only the second one, but I imagine, and we all plan on this being a very important part of our annual workshop schedule, and so I'm always reflecting, I'm always changing, I'm always improving. You know, both from the, you know, what the capability of the shop is like, but also from the student experience and everything. So I am very happy, and CMA is a really special place to be able to come here and work under these hammers creatively with a group of like-minded people, and the community building aspect of it all. And you know, it's really great. So I'm super happy and super lucky, but it comes with a lot of hard work, both mentally and physically.
I had the fortune of having dinner with you and your partner Aaron, and you guys broke out these, you know, basically picture albums, these books about from the first year of moving Center for Mental Arts from New York to Johnstown. Mm-hmm. And I was looking through these images and I'm thinking to my, I'm just like blown away about how much work's been done in the past 7 years, which is just monumental. Mm-hmm. If you were to think back to those days back in, what, 2018? Was that right? 2018? 2017. Does that Pat Quinn have, what are the expectations? Do you think that he would have felt that you've reached the expectations that he had in mind when you moved down to Johnstown?
Yeah, I mean, totally exceeded and blown them out of the water.
So, wow.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I looked at, moved here for the prospect to run those big hammers without any sort of concept of how we were going to do that or how long it would take. And, you know, I'm confident that the self-contained 2000 will be running by September of next year. So I would never would have imagined in less than 10 years we'd have three hammers running and running educational programming in that shop, you know. So I couldn't be happier. I just wish I was 10 years younger.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem.
I know.
That's the biggest problem. But I mean, it is looking through those, because I knew you before you moved down, and I just looking at a younger guy, not too much different. I mean, you know, 7 years isn't really that, you know, that long of a period of time.
A lot different, you know.
You think so? Tell me how you changed.
I was a fun guy back then.
Oh, you said that before. I don't like that. I don't like when you say that. I don't like it when you say that, frankly, because I don't think that's true. I think that you are. I think that you're locked in. You're focused. I mean, like you just said, you've exceeded the expectations of, you know, the fun guy you're referring to.
Yeah, I'm just half kidding. You know what I mean?
I know you are. It's just I just when I look at those pictures and I see the space, the raw space as you're walking through. I mean, I'm a much more superficial person. I'm thinking I would be like, oh, this is just too much work. I couldn't possibly tackle a project like this. And what you've done, just restoring one of the hammers, let alone two, and then creating the student space, and not to mention creating the residency, the place where people can stay, the rectory, where this terrific dormitory where people can stay. You've mm-hmm. like, I mean, it's just so much work. You've done it all.
Well, again, you know, it's with a crew and, right. and a community. Yeah. And I, you know, it's like, I do appreciate it. Right. Because, you know, personally have assumed a lot of risk coming out here and trying to make this a reality. And I do think like, lots of times to the general public or the public perception of CMA is that it's like the Pat Quinn thing sometimes or whatever, but I try really hard to make sure that everybody knows it's not only is none of this possible without Mark, Heidi, and Nate, but also, you know, the visiting instructors that come every year, but the general community who supports what we do and takes our classes and comes to the conference and volunteers their time, I think, like, overwhelmingly supportive, and this would not be successful without that. And you know, yeah, so a big thanks to everybody who's involved in this wonderful, you know, the forging community, honestly, the creative forging community that's, you know, blossoming right now is really great community to be involved in. It's like overwhelmingly positive, overwhelmingly inclusive and welcoming and all that kind of stuff. And to just be a small part of that, I think, is really special, and it makes me feel really good.
And how was the conference this past September?
Conference was great. Yeah. We had a great turnout, you know. Excuse me, numbers were a little bit lower than normal, but you know, it's never been about just getting as many people here as possible. It's more about, you know, crafting the right kind of, well, not the right kind of experience, but one that is creative and welcoming and showcasing all the hard work that we've done in the Octagon, but also this new aspect of it, which is the competition, which is really fun. That went really well. and just kind of growing that slowly but surely, and making it in the exhibition as well was really strong this year, and a lot of great young artists and really creative pieces. And it just, I feel like the CMA conference really highlights and showcases like next generation blacksmiths and a lot of the youngsters that are up and coming or in school, like at the American College of the Building Arts or, you know, Austin Community College or Carbondale or whatever, seem to come here to celebrate and have fun at that, at our conference and stuff like that. And I really, really like that. And that's not to knock the old folks, because they're important too. But as far as blacksmith events go, this one trends very young, which I think is really exciting.
It's super important.
Yeah.
Super important.
Yep.
And your direction with Center for Metal Arts about, you know, these, we've talked about this for to where blue in the face, but the idea is what's the role of these giant hammers, and, it, you know, to make art is like, is really something special. I mean, there's not many places in the United States who's able to make giant sculpture on this magnitude.
No. And then also for educational purposes, really, is also exciting too, because, you know, the people that perform the best in that shop are the people that have, like, you know, gone through some structured power hammer curriculum, whether that's at, you know, CMA or some other facility, educational facility. You know, it's really important, and it really helps you understand, you know, the how to move every movement you make. You want to be as efficient as possible in a shop like the Octagon because of the size and weight of the material and everything. So if you have the better understanding you have of making shapes on a smaller power hammer, the better experience you're going to have in that Octagon. And I can only speak from like this sort of like CMA community bubble, but it's like a lot of the work that I make in there, you know, is directly related, obviously, to the introduction to power hammer curriculum that I teach at CMA, you know, with, of course, some sort of, I expand on that kind of stuff a lot, but it's all rooted in the foundational techniques that I teach. So, you know, when I teach somebody or they come here for the Forging Focus or they've taken a lot of power hammer workshops with me, and then we go to the Octagon, it's very easy to train them because they already know exactly, you know, how the material should be moved, whether it's a top tool or a bottom tool, and, you know, the difference between like making parallel forgings versus tapered forgings, and the kind of like nuance, all, you know, the nuance around all those decisions and things like that. So it's, yeah, it's really fun.
One of the things I love is I feel as though you've become a better communicator to your students. And a lot of that is, I feel like, and you know, we were talking about people in general and people who are working in the Octagon with you, because it's so team dependent. And you've mentioned already the crews and communities and everything like that. You yourself have to be a little bit more attuned to how you express yourself, because when you're in the Octagon with a team, you have very, very specific tasks that have to be communicated and completely understood. There's not a position where you say, "Are you understand what you're doing?" and someone says, "I think so."
No.
Do you feel as though it's made you a better communicator?
It has, you know, and I think most people who know me or spend time with me, you know, think that I'm a very quiet individual, of which I am. I generally don't. Say things unless I know them to be true or feel really strongly about them. So my word selection and the amount of words that come out of my mouth are not very many. But in the Octagon, it's very important that you know what you're doing and you're able to communicate that clearly and loudly. And so it has made me a better communicator, and it's also made me a better researcher and blacksmith. And what it does really is it forces you to analyze every move, and not only the like how you do it, but the why you do it, which, you know, before we started working in the Octagon as much as we do now, has become a very important part of CMA's educational curriculum, because I, you know, it's really easy to show how, but it's not that easy to explain why. But everybody wants to know why, and the why really informs the how, and the two are just like they have to exist together. And so when you're working in the Octagon, the how and the why are super important, and then the communication to the team is super important, because it takes so much physical energy to get the material to the hammer. And sure, it's hot for a long time because of the thermal mass, but if you get it to the hammer and then you have to figure out what you're doing, it's incredibly frustrating, and it's a big waste of time and resources. So, you know, often meet with the team before every heat and come up with a plan and like draw it out on the floor or a chalkboard or something like that. Give everybody clearly defined roles, and then, you know, the team leader, whether that's the lead artist or somebody that's been assigned as team leader that's not the lead artist but knows the process, is sort of like a coach, or like, I don't know how to describe it, but you're giving very clear, like, commands, not in like a militant way, but very loud, clear, you know, directional sort of verbiage that lets the team know what they should be doing, when they should be doing it, and how it should be done. And then once that like starts to gel, then it becomes really efficient and really fun to be at the hammers, you know?
Yeah, I bet. I've always said that for me, when doing any kind of teaching or instructing, it makes me have a being able to explain it so people can be successful. It always gives me a better sense of what I'm doing if I'm able to kind of convey what I'm asking someone to do. Mm-hmm. And it always gives me a bit more understanding of the final goal.
Yeah.
And it's relatively rewarding.
Yeah, and I, you know, like you said about getting better at communicating, it's really important. And also, like, one thing that I've learned a lot, and you know, feedback from students as well, is like when I'm communicating at the hammer, we're before we get to the hammer and we have our little team roundup, and I'm like, okay, you know, we're gonna bring this thing over, we're gonna get it to the dies, you know, turn it parallel to the long dimension of the dies, and use the butcher to butcher in 3 inches, right? And then so on and so forth. And so you have this very clearly defined and achievable goal to reach during one heat, right? But there always is moments, because we're making sculpture, where you get to a point and you don't know what to do. And I call it like a blessing and a curse of being an artist that forges, is we have the blessing and the curse of almost never making the same thing twice. So we're always faced with a lot of problem solving and decision making that hopefully is based on, you know, prior experience and skills that we've developed from a foundational standpoint. But we're always making new and interesting shapes, which always presents new and interesting problems to solve and decisions to make. But when you're at the hammer and you get to that point, I found that the teams really respond well if you look at them and you're like, all right, everybody, we're at a point now where I'm not quite sure what the next thing to do is. Why don't we go ahead and get it back in the fire and then go over to the chalkboard and let's talk about what our options are, you know, rather than be at the hammer and like pretend you know what to do and then have them rotate the material like a bunch of ways that don't turn out to work very well, lose a lot of heat, expend a lot of energy, and then make the team frustrated. You stop, You look within yourself, you go, I don't know everything. And I'm going to say that to the crew, right? Because it's okay to be vulnerable. And then we're going to put the thing back in the fire so it heats up, and we're going to create a plan so that we all know what to do when we come out again. Maybe it's going to work, maybe it's not, but at least we'll all be on the same page. Because when you're not on the same page, it gets chaotic. And if the right. if the lead smith doesn't know what they're doing, or the team leader or whatever, and then everybody on the team starts shouting out what they want to do, is no, turn it clockwise, no, spin it this way. Wait, oh God, where are my tongs? Like, that is not a great way to work at these hammers making creative sculptural forgings, you know? So that's like the where the communication really comes into play, and the teams that I've worked with have really benefited from that and appreciated that sort of level of openness and communication.
I would think that some of the team would also rise to the occasion when you say, all right, let's go to the chalkboard and kind of figure this out.
Definitely. And that's the time, like, and this is like hard to say because I don't want people to misunderstand this, but like at the hammer with hot metal, one person calling the shots. That's not the time to be like, what if we do this? Or, you know, this person's on the tongs and they're like, ah, I think it would be better. That's not the time for that. The time for that's at the chalkboard.
Right.
And if you feel like you have that idea when we're forging, it's like just keep it to yourself and save it for the chalkboard, because it gets received much better there and it can be considered by everybody in sort of like a quiet, more contemplative space, you know? I mean, I love getting feedback from all the students, and it's not uncommon for a student to be like, Pat, I think it would work better if we rotated it this way and used this tool. And I go, oh, you know what? You're absolutely right. Let's try that. But in the heat of the moment is not the time for like group decision making, you know what right. I mean?
Ugh. See, but this is part of the, you know, you've only done this 4 times around, not including the anvil making. It's three or four times. So you're actually learning based on the experience of what can happen in the octagon based on experience.
Yeah, and it's sculpture or it's anvil making or it's stock making or whatever we're doing or just having like a play day or whatever. It's all led up to like, you know, my philosophy about how to work and communicate in that shop, that I feel really strongly about, that students have also, you know, confirmed, and validated the way I feel about it.
What are you looking forward to heading towards 2026?
Everything. And, okay. I think the biggest thing that I'm looking forward to that I'm working on really hard right now is buttoning up all the loose ends for us to launch our very first 1-year-long program at CMA that we're calling the Passport Program. We've got some very generous funding from some very generous foundations that are incredibly supportive of our educational mission here, and mostly related to the long-term workshops and the scholarship portions of what we do. So, you know, with some major funding and some additional funding, we were able to put together this sort of like dream or vision that we've had as an organization for a little while of creating like a 1-year program. It's like a certificate program. I don't really want to call it a certificate program, but essentially that's what it is. It's like a residency / internship / certificate program, but you come to CMA for a full year, participate in every one of our workshops, including the long-term stuff, with the addition of a new scholarship-funded 4-week workshop that focuses on the creation and installation of a major architectural iron piece. all the way through your last 6 weeks at the winter residency, working on a final project based on your own research and interests. That's like the elevator pitch, I guess.
That's exciting.
Yeah, we should get into that at some point here, like in a lot of detail, because I got a lot to say about it, but I'm getting the sense we might want to take a couple questions here.
Look at you. You serve it up to me on a silver platter. You did a good job. Unbelievable.
Almost like I've done this before, huh?
Yeah, you're unbelievable. Oh, guys, God. Listen, Pat's here to answer your questions. And we're going to answer some of your questions. This is a great question with Pat Quinn, obviously. If you want to send in your forging questions, you can definitely send them to handforgedinvt. That's Pat's Instagram. I'll have all that information on the show notes where you get this. Or you can go to Full Blast Podcast on Instagram, and then you can send us your questions, just as our man Peter Braspenix, Fire Forge, has. And he asks, what are your thoughts on the relevance of forge work in today's modern world? That's a big one.
Yeah, that's a great question. Can you do me a favor and repeat that question?
Yes. What are your thoughts on the relevance of forge work in today's modern world?
Did we answer this one already?
I don't think so. No, I don't think so.
Oh, man. I guess I'm just procrastinating. I think it's incredibly relevant from a creative standpoint and a functional standpoint. I think it's changed a lot from how relevant it used to be. When you think more along the lines of like colonialism and, a village blacksmith that's here to help a smaller subset of society function through the creation and maintenance of tools and hardware and things like that, to more like industrial large scale applications like nuclear pressure vessels and things for big like Navy ship shafts and things, aircraft landing gear, like all that stuff has to be forged still, and everybody really encounters tons of stuff in their daily life that is forged. We just don't realize it that much because it's sort of hidden, or it's under the hood of your car, or it doesn't look forged because of modern manufacturing practices have changed and forging processes have become more streamlined. So I think it's really relevant and still present and more so than I think we all sort of realize. But it doesn't scream forged work as one would generally tend to think of it, like a forged hinge or a thumb latch or something like that.
Do you think that there's a possibility that it could be more of a visual thing? I mean, you think about forging and there's these, especially when you look at the sculpture you guys have made, there are these telltale signs in the process that screams, okay, this was forged, this was not cast. And it feels as though, is there a possibility that this could kind of with the exception of just art, do you think that this is something that can be more widely seen as a terrific application or addition to modern architecture or, how we see the world in general?
I don't know, man, because the whole like look of forging is not, that's reserved for craftspeople or artists, I feel like, or like process-driven interests, right? And so I think like most of the forging, that happens nowadays that's not creative is not about the look. It's right. More about it being the right way to make the thing, like a pressure vessel, for instance, it doesn't matter. But if it's forged, it's much stronger than if it's fabricated. And if it's forged out of one piece with two caps rather than like a rolled piece of plate with a seam, that's the best process for that outcome or for that use, you know, and then that gets fully machined after it gets forged. So it has nothing to do with what it looks like. But then there's people like us who love the process so much from a creative standpoint that we can let the evidence of the process show in the finished work. But that I think is like a very new mindset and philosophy, you know, and if you even think of like forged tools from the late 1700s or early 1800s, and I'm not like a historian on this sort of stuff, but I'll just use like box joint pliers as an example where that was a tool that a lot of crafts needed to make their work that employed a blacksmith to make it, but it doesn't look forged because it's been completely filed and whitesmithed after it's been forged. And so, like, you know, back then blacksmiths were forging also because it was the right way to get the desired function of a tool or something like that, but they weren't like, whoa, like this looks so cool because it's forged. You know, forging was a means to an end, and then it got cleaned up. And I think, like, you know, in modern days, even like throughout the 1900s or like, you know, tools and fixtures and things that were made in the octagon here, a lot of them went to the machine shop afterward to get machined because they were parts to machines or, you know, backup rolls for rolling mills or crane hooks or something like that. And like the idea of like having something look forged is really new in the lifespan of this thing, or like like celebrating that, I think. And maybe I'm totally wrong, who knows, but yeah. And even there, you know, there's like, I always joke around, there's like whack it with a ball peen to give it that forged look, you know. It's like people there, you know, we could have a whole conversation about whether something that looks forged is attractive to a modern consumer or not. To some people it is, and to some people it isn't. I think it depends on where you are and who you associate with or whatever. But you know, I take the stance more of like, you know, I want to forge it because I'm trying to make a three-dimensional shape, and that's the best way to do it without losing a ton of material or spending my life like grinding away material. I just want to redistribute where it is. I don't like give it texture just to make it look forged. If it has texture from the forging, that's great. I don't sand it off or anything, but I also don't just do it just to make it look forged, which I know there are people out there that do that and they sell their work based on that mindset or whatever, but I'm often actually like, you know, planishing at a low heat to kind of smooth out my surfaces after I forge them and stuff. And I think that like, and not tooting my own horn here because other smiths do it as well, but I believe that like there's a certain level of refinement there and you know, finishing of the process that can be really attractive.
We had a question early on, and I lost the guy's name, but when you were talking about low heat, it kind of jogged my memory in regards to our conversations that we had. You talk to me. The question was originally, what do you think of the induction forges? Now, the induction forges, just to describe what an induction forge is, can we just describe? Do you think you can describe what one is? I don't even know how I would describe what an induction forge is.
I can't either, but I know that it uses electricity really to heat up the material. I have no idea from a scientific level how it works.
There's like a coil, and you stick the material into the coil, and then it magically heats up is the only thing I can think of.
Yeah, I don't know how it works, and I don't care. I just know it works really well for certain processes, and so, you know, I'm excited to, we just acquired one over here, and I used one actually in Canada when I was demoing at Can Iron, and it knocked my socks off.
Really?
Yeah, and I thought, like, I cannot live another day as a blacksmith without having an induction forge in my shop. And so I made that a reality one way or another, and I still have some work to do. You know, I know we're not really looking for sponsorships or endorsements or anything like that yet, but I'm excited to give it a go and see how it performs and report back. But my experience, my very, very small experience with it was, it was just on half-inch square bar, but it got so hot, like way hotter than my gas forge could ever get anything. And I'm so not interested in hand forging, and I'm so not interested in hand forging material that's not as hot as it can be, which is almost everything from, you know, modern gas forges or whatever. But I like it got the material like white hot, you know, and certainly got it yellow. And you know, the forges, the gas forges that we have, that most people have, you can get a bright orange, maybe yellow, but that's about it. And so, you know, if I'm going to be swinging a hammer at something and it's white versus orange, it's, your energy is going to go a lot further. And I'm super interested in like super localized heat for, you know, things like final set tong jaws, or, you know, forging the bits on the V bits where you only need like an inch or so of the material to be hot, but you don't need all that radiant heat from the gas forge, you know, soaking into your whole piece and stuff like that. So I think it's going to be, I'm into it, man. And I'm looking forward to setting it up and giving it a go.
Can you describe the difference between, in regards to when you're hitting something that's orange, you know, max out at a gas forge and is, you know, a little bit higher than orange, to moving material at like yellow or white?
Well, it's like hitting a piece of cold material versus like hitting a stick of butter. You know, and it's like, I don't, you know, I use gas forge a lot, right? Because I'm a power hammer smith. So ultimately I'm not using my arms and muscles and tendons to really like rely on getting the shape I want. I'm using a big machine, so if it's like, you know, orange, I'm okay, because you know, it's still going to do it, and I can just go back in and keep working without damaging my body or whatever. But when I teach, almost everything I teach now, I teach out of the coal forges at CMA, because I'm not interested in orange heat. I'm interested in yellow heat. And the coal forges are able and willing to get the material that hot, and your energy goes really far. And I think like when it comes to teaching basic forging to people, the first technique you have to learn is not tapering, it's not shouldering, it's not parallel forging, it's heating up the metal. And a lot of people skip right over that, and they go right into swinging a hammer at the anvil. And so we spend significant amount of time here teaching fire management, with the help of Mark Kelly, coal fire management and maintenance, so that when you pull your material out and bring it over to the anvil, you're using your energy the most efficient way possible.
Yeah, that's amazing. I have very limited experience with the induction forge, and I did like the localized parts of it. Like I could heat up something in the middle of a piece and not have to worry about one side or the other being hot. It's amazing. I love the I feel as though fire heat management is something that's kind of usually overlooked, and I don't think that I ever really thought about it as much until I talked to you. And yeah. I would imagine that, you know, that's a that's amazing. I didn't expect you to be as I don't know what I expected. I don't know. The induction forge to me, I always feel like it's like this new thing.
It's not. Dude, I mean, they use them in industry, honestly, and it's like I've seen these. It's not new technology, so you know, let's put that out there already. But what is new, just like with power hammers, like and presses, is making it available to the hobbyist.
Okay,
that is new.
Okay,
right. So, having induction heat has been done in industry for a long, long time. And it's not new. And in fact, there's production shops will use induction heating to heat up bars that pass through a coil on some sort of pusher, right? So, you know, the bar is passing through the coil and heating up, and it's pushing it at the right speed so that, you know, when 8 inches of that bar comes out the end of the coil, there's a machine there that cuts it right off hot. It rolls right down a chute to the blacksmith, and then they forge it. And as they're forging it, the next 8 inches is being pushed right through that coil, getting up to temperature and stuff like that. So, like, and then in the old axle plant here, you know, the neighboring building to CMA, there's a huge induction heater in there. But it's an induction heater for a crucible. So they're using induction heat to actually melt metal. And that, you know, and so that's like, it's not new technology, but it's new availability of technology.
Wow. Thanks for setting me straight on that one. I had no idea. I guess, you know, you see these small ones and you're just like, this is kind of new to the, you're right. It's new to anybody who wants to have something in their shop that they don't want to burn their shop down. You know, it's like there's not a smoke, there's not a lot of, all right, I've said enough.
Yeah, no, and it's exactly right, you know, and there's a big market out there to make tools and equipment for the hobbyist who lives in a residential neighborhood that wants to make work on an anvil and with a press or whatever. And more power to them. I love that. It's getting the accessibility of the craft out there to a lot of different people. And induction forges, I think, are part of that. And I'm excited because I don't have a coal forge on my side of the shop. So, you know, I'm always longing for that yellow white heat, but I can't get it. So having the induction forge over in the research shop there is going to be, I think, really helpful. So, yeah.
Well, I look forward to when you get that set up and we talk about the applications, especially to sculpture.
Yeah.
All right. Next one comes from our man DW Wood Builds. Any time frame on restoring the A-frame hammer? That's the giant hammer in the back room of the Octagon.
Yeah, the double arch.
Double arch.
Yeah, well, I've been optimistically saying to people maybe 5 years.
Okay.
I think 2026, obviously, we're going to be focused on, fixing and running the 2000 self-contained Chambersburg, which will be really exciting. But then at that point, all the hammers in the Octagon will have been restored.
Amazing.
And that leaves, that leaves two left. There's one in a side room that's like a 1200 Niles Beemit, and then the double arch in the back room. And I can't say for sure, but my gut tells me that we'll probably start to poke away at the double arch before the little 1200. But, you know, it's not such a simple restoration job from a logistical standpoint, so we'll have to dig into it and see what happens. But, you know, fixing the hammer is one thing. Having a furnace to service it is another. And then, you know, acquiring material that's big enough to actually warrant the use of the hammer is another. And then there's access to the building, to that room with forklifts and overhead doors. And if we take the hammer apart, do we have to take the roof off? There's a lot of stuff to consider. So,
wow. What an operation that you've been thinking about.
Yeah. Oh. So 5 years is optimistic, but I don't think it's unachievable. We'll just play it by ear.
Think about what you've done in seven.
Right, exactly.
You know, amazing. Amazing. Yeah. Let's drop down to Narum and Knives. He's a great dude, not too far from Jesse. Can students travel a long distance and stay in the facilities the night before classes start?
Yeah, definitely. That's something to, you know, coordinate with Heidi in our office, and something we facilitate to students for sure. So if it's not explicitly available as an option on the website, a simple phone call to the office would take care of it quite easily, I believe. Yep, we try to accommodate, you know, as many people as we can.
And by the way, the rectory is terrific. It's always spotless, and it's such a nice place to be, and people kind of, you know, congregate in the kitchen, and it's just, it's a really, really, really nice place to be. So
thanks, Jeff.
I'm appreciative of that. And there's always hot water, and the bathrooms are always spotless. You can eat off the floors. The whole place is dynamite. Yeah. I love sleeping in room number four. Room number four is for me 100%, but all of them are great. All the rooms are great.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to Caffeined Forge. Any plans? We might have answered this a while ago, but we'll just bring it back. Any plans on an anvil forging class?
Yeah, there are. I might sort of like wrap that into introduction to utility hammer forging, or I've really began to realize that, you know, the goal in that shop is about the community, and it's about the teams, right? It's about the teams at the hammer, and it's about, I used to think that like we would talk a lot about visiting instructors and getting international artists in there and stuff like that, and that is still a huge goal of ours, but I've been thinking a lot about like the importance of training students and other people on those hammers, because for every one visiting instructor, you need 10 competent blacksmiths if you want to use both the hammers, like, you know, full stop. And so, you know, one visiting instructor's vision is only as achievable as, you know, the competence of the teams around the hammer. So I'm considering offering these classes that are like introduction to forging in the octagon, per se, like where you come to CMA and we work in the octagon, but we basically do, you know, my introduction to power hammer curriculum that we do in the small classroom, but we do it on the big hammers and we use like 5 and 6 inch round instead of 1 inch round. So as to like get more people exposed to working in that space and familiar with all the different roles and responsibilities it takes to do so. And then, you know, one might be able to distill anvil forging into a series of basic techniques, and that one might be me, and so that might be an outlet for that sort of thing. So it could be like an anvil making workshop that's really like a introduction to steam hammer workshop, or some sort of combination of the two. I have been thinking about it. I think I still have a bit more research R&D to do before, you know, before like putting all my research out there. But I have been considering it, and I do believe it's a a real possibility in the not so distant future.
Whoa. Unbelievable.
But I mean, there's two ways to do it, right? There's like, come here and make anvils, you know, that stay here and get used in the classroom. I mean, it's a big goal of mine to forge all the anvils for the classroom. And then there's another way of doing it, which is like, come here and make your own anvil, which are two very different experiences. And perhaps one has to happen before the other, and one has to also figure out, you know, the price point of each so that CMA doesn't wind up in the hole.
Right.
But yeah, there's two real clear avenues, I feel like.
And it's not like a hammer making class where you can heat treat a hammerhead in, you know, just stick it in the even heat and then drop it in your water.
Yeah, I mean, doubt.
An anvil is a little bit more of an operation to heat treat.
Yeah, and it's also not a machining class, right? So I'm trying to figure out, one of the things I've been working on recently is the creation of a smaller anvil in that shop and one that relies much less on, you know, machined connections between two legs and a bridge top or something like that, something that's a little more accessible, a little easier to take home with you and use. But the heat treatment and the machining of the anvil is arguably more time-consuming and labor-intensive than the forging, and that is definitely not something I'm prepared to teach, nor can I facilitate the heat treatment. But I can point you in the right direction for somebody that can do it for you. So,
but that also brings us back to when you were talking about with Peter Brasmanek's question, and we were talking about when you're forging something and it goes to the machine shop. You know, you're looking at those classic bridge anvils that were made in the facility. They weren't focusing on machining them down. They were just machining down the parts that needed to be exposed. The exposed parts that needed to be machined down.
Yeah, definitely. they just the connections, just the surfaces, you know, I mean, it's kind of like calls back to what we were talking about. It's like you forge what needs to be forged and you machine what needs to be machined, and then you don't do any extraneous processes based on aesthetic.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the things I love, and we were actually talking with some of the students in regards to looking at the hammers, the anvils that you forge, where you're leaving the exposed pooch at the end of the with the end of the anvil that kind of like shows the forging process. It's just like not forgetting where it came from.
Yeah, my love letter, right?
It is. I mean, I took pictures of all the cutoffs you have of all the pooches you've cut off in sculpture. You have this table, and there's just like this village of these little cutoff pooches. And
my pooch garden.
It's a pooch garden. Well, your pooch garden. It's beautiful. I mean, it's just this. It's this beautiful love note to the fact that you hit the steel and then the steel moved from the middle, and it didn't. You know, you didn't have. You know, this, it was the proper heat and it was the proper hit. And it's like, it's not as subtle as if you really think about what it is.
Right.
You know, it's that the heat was right. The hit was right. The positioning was right. And the material moved. You hit it down and then the move from the middle out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Exactly. From core to surface.
From core to surface. And that's a class too, right?
That's the name of our exhibition, our annual exhibition.
The exhibition. That's right. That's right. Okay, let's go with Steve King. Steve King says, here's a question for Pat. What steel do you use for power hammer dies, and what temperature do you temper the dies after hardening? Thanks again, Steve.
Great question, Steve. I don't know that I could answer it fully, but I've used everything. No, sorry. I've used 4140. And 4340 only, and I have not ever heat treated power hammer dies personally. Even a chunk of metal. I guess I've made them for. I made the dies for my Nazelle and my Ritter, and I don't know. I probably could have heat treated the Ritter dies here, but I sent them to a heat treat facility to do for me because when you do that, they go, "Yes, sir. What Rockwell would you like that?" And you give them a number, and then you get your dies back successfully heat treated and tempered. And I want to forge. I don't want to heat treat. So some of those things I pass off to shops and individuals who have that technology and science figured out and can do it much better and more efficiently than I can. And that leaves me available to do more forging, which is what I like better. Same can be said about the machining of the dovetails on power hammer dies. I've done that myself and still like to do that myself a little bit because I find it to be a valuable educational experience for me at the mill to machine the dovetails both from a measuring and also a actual machining standpoint. So I tend to get some enjoyment out of that because I feel like every time I do it, I get better as a machinist, of which I'm not very good. So I celebrate that. But when it comes to heat treating, I'm simply not interested, and I want it to be done right and professional for the longevity of the tool and the safety of everybody around me. So whenever possible, I try to pass that off to a shop.
Okay. All right. We're going to add old favorite. I don't know if it's an old favorite, but bring us back. Zach Mapes asks, what is the recommended hammer size? I find trying to move metal with a 3-pound hammer, it gets done a lot quicker. Then dropping down to an 18-ounce for form and fit. What do the experts say? I think this is a good question to kind of recircle back every once in a while.
I think we should find some experts and ask them then.
Well, now that we don't have any experts, we're like all of a sudden raising our hands. What's your opinion on hammer size? And I know it's changed over the years.
But not really too much, my opinion is lighter hammer, higher heat. So whatever that means to you for what you're doing, is the right thing to do. But, 2 pound and 1/4 pound, I think is a pretty sweet all purpose forging size. And, that's without the handle. I usually make tools to weight based on the tool itself without the handle. And so if you placed on a scale after the handle's in it, it'll read a little bit heavier. But that's the range for me. And I'm much more focused on getting my material hot enough for that hammer to do something than I am like getting a somewhat hot piece of metal and hitting it with a much bigger hammer. I don't think that's sustainable, and I think it can be potentially damaging to your body and just physically exhausting, honestly. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Love it. And here's the last question from Matt Mabane, Matt with a pan. Great dude. Never forged before, and he's asking a really great question. Are there shapes or slash forms or tools that are notoriously difficult to forge? And the opposite, is there anything that's easy to forge? And he's got no experience whatsoever, and he's just like, really interested in the concept.
Yeah. There's shapes that are easy. Easier and shapes that are difficult. And I think, let me think this one through out loud. Forging is neither additive nor reductive. Simply put, I mean, you can make it both, but you know, in its simplest form, it's working with a finite amount of volume and using heat and pressure to redistribute where the material is, right? And so one thing to consider when you're forging, I think every shape can be hard and every shape can be easy. It just depends on your understanding of the basic principles of forging. And so what I mean by that is when you strike the material with a hammer or a tool, the shape of that tool is going to dictate the direction in which the material goes in. And if you use a tool that is advantageous for the direction you want the material to go, then you're going to find that your shapes become easier to make. But if you use a tool where it goes in all directions, like a flat surface on a flat surface, or like a round top surface on a, or like a spherical top surface on a flat bottom surface, your material is going to go in all directions. And if you only want your material to go long, then you have to constantly work to take the material that went in the direction you don't want it to go and make it go in the direction you want it to go. And that's going to make your shape harder to forge. So I think like basic understanding of tool shapes and directions is really important to make as many shapes easy as possible. And I think easy shapes fall in the category of tapers, parallel forgings, squares, rounds of both of those. And any shape that doesn't really have shoulders in it. And I think once you introduce shouldering, you start to complicate your shapes, right? And so if you have one-sided shoulder, that becomes a little bit easier because you don't have to consider shoulders around the entire cross-section. But then as you move into like a four-sided shoulder, or, you know, another way to describe that would be like a tenon, like a round tenon off of a round bar or a square tenon off of a square bar, that becomes a little more complicated because you need specialty tooling in order to make it cleanly and efficiently. So, I don't know. Does that?
Yeah.
Right.
Actually, it brings me to one of the great t-shirts that I got from you this past weekend. And it's a motto that I know you've been talking about for quite a while. Fighting the rhombus.
Mm-hmm.
Fighting the rhombus. Can you tell me why we are to fight the rhombus? And what is the rhombus? And why are we getting here? And how do we prevent it?
That's funny. Actually, the easiest shape to make is a rhombus. So, unfortunately, it's often one that we don't actually want. So, you know, that's where fighting the rhombus came from originally. I think it's funny because I don't love the concept of fighting something, but I do think it works in this context. But you know, forging a square cross section is difficult and it takes attention to detail, both visually and also physically, right? So you have to pay very close attention to your hammer control and your tong control in order to not have a rhombus. And if you're not always conscious of that and always making micro corrections as you forge, you know, when you're learning how to forge, rhombuses can happen easily and they can be very unwelcome. And so a big part of my curriculum is teaching students how to identify when it's happening and what the best ways of correction are, of which there's several. So we at CMA talk about fighting the rhombus all the time, and that's become a big part of our lexicon and curriculum, and to the point where I've even gotten matching tattoos with a bunch of students about rhombus corrections. And so this character has wound up on a t-shirt. So he's immortalized on skin and fabric.
Wow. That's dedication.
Yeah.
That is major dedication. Yeah. For me, it's my dyes are off center, or one's a little bit different than the other, or if I'm holding it, I'm a little bit lackadaisical. All of a sudden, my square, reins, all of a sudden they become rhombus, and then all of a sudden I turn on the diagonal to try to break the corners to kind of fix the problem, and it's always just lack of preparation in my experience. And no, what I do when I do the rhombus, it always comes down to lack of preparation. Always. Yeah. And I know it. And anytime I see it, I'm just like, well, you weren't prepared.
Yeah, I gotcha.
So 2025 is coming to an end. What are you looking forward to next?
Making sculpture. Thinking about Octagon stuff, restoring the 2000 and launching the 1 year program.
And how can people learn more about CMA?
You can follow us on Instagram, even though that seems pretty broken at the moment. If you really want to see our stuff, you would probably isn't there a way you can favorite stuff on Instagram?
I think so.
You know, algorithms are totally bonkers, and we don't invest monetarily in Instagram at the moment. So I feel like all of our content is not getting seen, but you can go to the website, centerformetalarts.org, and get on our mailing list, I think, because we're doing a little bit more energy towards both physical and digital newsletters. We promise it's not going to be annoying in your inbox, but a more direct way of reaching our community than, you know, Instagram is so indirect at this point. It's just, it's almost seeming like a waste of time and energy. But I'd get on the mailing list for the newsletters, because we'll be going maybe quarterly or bi-monthly or something with all the necessary information for participation in our programs, of which there's a lot. And there's a lot of scholarship opportunities. So if you want to learn here and, you know, there's financial restrictions, there's a way to participate. So I would say get on the mailing list and follow us on all the social medias, and just reach out. Happy to chat and talk with folks and stuff like that. So look forward to hearing from everybody.
I love the catalogs. I think the catalogs are beautifully made. The pictures are beautiful. I love everything about it. And I think your website's great.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Guys, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go into the link and follow Pat Quinn, Center for Mental Arts. I want you to follow Pat at Handforge and VT. I want you to get on the newsletter, get involved. Feel free to follow Full Blast Podcast on Instagram and send in some forging questions for the next episode of Great Question with Pat Quinn. Pat, dude, I cannot thank you enough. You've really been incredibly inspiring. And every time I go down, I'm always reinvigorated and kind of fired, more fired up than I expect to be. So thank you.
You're welcome. Well, thanks for coming. Thanks for your support. And look forward to having you back, of course. And maybe someday come to the conference.
Yes, I have to.
And that's that. Thanks for being a part of this community and helping us out, man. I really appreciate it.
Dude, I appreciate you. Guys, thank you for listening. Thank you for the support. And we will see you next week. Pat, you are the man.
Thanks, buddy.